Welcome to the Earned First podcast. My name is Arun Sudarman, founding editor at Earned First. I'm very happy to be joined today by Alka Winter, who's the vice president for destination marketing and communications at the Ras Al Khaimah Tourism Development Authority. Alka, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Arun. Really happy to be here this morning.
So you are not only an expert on tourism and hospitality, PR and marketing. You've been in the hospitality sector for many years. Before Ras Al Khaimah, you were at Accor, I think, for several years, including as VP of Global Comms. And you've been based in the UAE for how many years now?
It's coming up to about 18 years. So I've been right in the region, wow, and in the UAE for quite some time.
Okay. So you know the, I think you know the region pretty well. And I think particularly when you're working in destination marketing and tourism, you get a really good understanding of culture and nation branding, and indeed the kind of changing media landscape, all topics that we will address on today's podcast. I'd been to the region a couple of times already this year. In fact, you spoke at our Reprise event a couple of weeks ago, which I thought went well. But the thing that really struck me is when I have these conversations often with people in the industry around the world, there's a reasonable amount of angst. You know, there's concerns about economics, about geopolitics, about the future of agencies, and about the impact of AI. But when I was in the Gulf, I felt there was much less angst. There was a lot of positivity. Of course, we're all aware that the economic indicators are probably a lot healthier in the region. But how do you see it from your perspective? Is it largely a positive mindset this year? Or are you seeing any angst at all?
I think we're seeing a lot of optimism, and you see that year on year. The region, despite, you know, geopolitics and things that are affecting the UAE and the GCC broader, there is a sense of optimism. And, you know, the fact that the UAE was ranked the safest country in the world, that was just announced a couple of weeks ago, is really telling. I like to cite that there's an Economist article that I read about a year and a half ago, that said the messier the world gets, the more the UAE seems to thrive. And, you know, there's really nothing keeping the country down. Announcing mega projects like Disney in Abu Dhabi, we're going to be having the first integrated resort with Wynn, the GCC Unified Visa, which is a Schengen-style visa that facilitates and makes it a lot easier to travel to neighboring GCC countries. I just think the Emirates are on the rise.
It certainly feels that way. As you note, a beacon of stability almost in a very turbulent world. And we'll talk a little bit more about that later on. But first of all, you are someone I think that is very intimately acquainted with the media landscape in the UAE, in the broader Gulf region. And there's been a lot of change, I think, even within that region in recent years. What are the biggest shifts that you're seeing, first of all, in terms of the rise of new media, the evolution of, dare I say, old media, and how is that impacting the work that you do?
It's a really interesting question, and it's really coming from all angles. I know we've been talking about AI the last 2 years, and it has upended everything. There really is a seismic shift. And, you know, since the advent of the internet, 30 years ago, like this is the next big thing that's happening to us. And in our discipline in communications and in the tourism space, we're looking at specifically where search is going. And it's going a couple of directions. We're seeing that a lot of travelers are using AI for their planning needs, you know, setting up itineraries and such. You know, 50% of travelers are going to be using AI to plan their travel. There's platforms like Perplexity that already you can make bookings on their platform directly. So this whole notion of one click less just got a lot more easier. And then social is becoming the number one source for travel inspiration at 77%, which is really telling. my DMO website, so a tourism website, attracts about 45% of that. OTA websites, 35%. So no one's really dreaming on my website or on an OTA. They're getting their inspiration from social. And that really transitions into an area called social commerce. It hasn't really taken flight yet in tourism. And there's a couple reasons why. But that gap between inspiration on social and actual conversion is really interesting. And there is a big commercial opportunity for social media to capitalize on that. You know, I speak to a good friend of ours, Jeremy Johnsey, who's the CEO of Beautiful Destinations, his content development platform, and they have beautiful, you know, videos and landscapes, and they dwell into, you know, tourism. They're trying to bridge that gap, working with the likes of Expedia. So we are seeing some movement there. But it's really interesting how our jobs have changed and how the discipline of PR and marketing has changed along with it. You know, we're looking at now the rise of the sovereign creator. So you see a move from the center, from the brand, the masthead, all the way to becoming an individual creator. Substack is a great example of that. I think they just raised $100 million. Their evaluation is at $1 billion. They've got over 5 million paid subscribers. And it's showing that shift of journalists leaving the center and striking it out on their own and curating an audience that, you know, subscribes to their views. It's really interesting. And then you've got traditional media like The Economist that I mentioned. It's almost two centuries old, but the names of the journalists, the contributors, is never listed because, you know, the magazine, the brand, has a collective voice. So it's such a super interesting time. I mean, you must be seeing this as well from your perspective.
Yeah, it's very interesting because I think, as you mentioned, it's almost like a spectrum. You have The Economist at one end, no journalists named, and then you have independent creators at the other end, where there is, I guess, no media brand, and it is only the individual journalist. You mentioned the influence of social and of AI, and I want to talk about both of those a little bit. Let's start with social. It's very interesting that you're seeing increasing conversion from social platforms, first of all. I assume a lot of that is being driven by creators on social channels. I think we're all familiar now with the travel and tourism influencers. They are everywhere. How are you working with them? Is it purely a paid media channel? Or do you find it's important to kind of maintain that sort of credibility, perhaps, that a public relations mindset can bring?
I think it's a combination of both. You know, there is influencers do have to make a living and, you know, they need to monetize their work. And if it's a good brand fit, then it just makes sense. But we're seeing a lot of collaborations, especially with our PR team and our PR agency, just, you know, working on those collaborations. One of them is Stellantis Jeep is one of the clients of our PR agency. And we were launching a summer promotion, which invited visitors to come experience our mountains, our nature, areas that's cooler in the summer, especially for this region. And they worked with influencers and Stellantis to bring over media and influencers in Jeeps to, you know, to our terrains, which made perfect sense. So I think, you know, to your point, it is a combination of both that you need to look at. I just think the area of influencers is really a tricky one to navigate through. I don't know if you watch Black Mirror. There's an episode. It's almost like the Twilight Zone, which I grew up with. There's an episode in season three called Nosedive. And it's a whole society where they get rated. So every interaction, the interaction we're having now, if I feel it's a good interaction, I'll give you 5 stars and your ranking goes up. And it shows how some, you know, interactions are superficial. You just want the rating. But based on that, you're able to afford a better apartment. You get, you know, priority seating on flights. It's an interesting commentary on influencer culture. So I think we're treading lightly on that. And it's the brand first. It just has to make good sense from a brand perspective.
Almost like a social credit. Well, I'm very hopeful you will give this interaction 5 stars. but let's see. So the rise of platforms like Perplexity, very interesting that now, you know, people are making bookings directly from AI platforms. How's that changing your work? Are you finding you're having to recalibrate messaging? Are you having to consider different types of channels? Is it different tone, different language? What's the impact of AI search, or as they're calling it, I think GEO, on your work and your efforts?
Definitely, we need to rethink how we do all that. You know, the fact that bookings can happen on a social platform or on an AI platform is very telling. We're not really seeing the social commerce part in tourism yet. There's a couple of reasons why. Mm-hmm. I think travel is a lot more considered than e-commerce. So if I were to buy, you know, a dress on a social platform, it's easy to do. The commitment is really low risk, whereas there's a lot of moving parts when it comes to travel and tourism. And that's why, you know, you're being redirected to OTAs or to brand.com website from a hotel or an airline. So we're seeing shifts in that way. But from a communication standpoint, it really calls into question how we market and how we communicate, the types of messaging we get out there. The fact that, you know, what we used to write that journalists would receive is completely different now to the audiences we're going after. And it really, you know, this whole area of PR and its relevancy and how it's changing, and is it changing fast enough? My career started in PR. I have a postgraduate in public relations, and I remember the first semester was all about grammar and writing. I have a copy of Strunk and White's Elements of Styles, and then learning AP style, and that was drilled in. That's kind of gone by the wayside a bit. And I think, you know, the question for PR professionals is, what does earned mean now? Mm-hmm. Traditionally, was earned media was, you know, journalists writing about you and, you know, media clippings and AVE, though antiquated that, you know, metric is now. And now the shift is, you know, going back to first principles, what does earned mean? And it's unpaid third-party validation. So it's not just media, it's communities. And it's across a whole spectrum of platforms, from digital, social, live stream, podcasts, as we're speaking today on. So it really has upended everything. And it's really interesting. And I think the responsibility of PR is certainly there. Christopher Lasley from Razor PR said this. He said, you know, advertising's job is to build brand affinity. PR's job is really to shift those entrenched attitudes and behaviors. So it's something a lot more relevant. It's changing perspectives.
So you can envisage perhaps, you know, that writing for AI platforms, for example, becomes something that's a different thing compared to traditional media relations. But I'm curious also to hear about how AI is changing your own role. You know, are you using it to hone your media relations? Have you created a digital twin? Is it taking on more of your workload? Or like some of the people I talk to, are you a little bit concerned that perhaps you are offloading your brain to ChatGPT?
Cognitive offloading. It's interesting, but I don't think it happened just with AI. Look at the calculator. Cognitive offloading is there. You just need to know what muscle you want to keep strong. Something that I had seen recently from Will.i.am from Black Eyed Peas, he was asked, how do you use AI in your creative process? And interestingly, he said, you know, the core idea, the nugget, comes from me. And then AI comes in as a multiplier, you know, different variations on a theme. And in this sense, you know, AI is the additive. So I think once you start offloading, you know, core functions, then, you know, your mind does get duller, but it's up to you to decide what you want to offload and what you want to keep intact. And then how we use AI. An area that you mentioned is digital twins. So, you know, we market in over 18 countries. And, you know, it's the standard targeting that we look at, demographics, you know, their income bracket, education level. So we can be targeting a couple in the UK from ages, you know, 25 to 45, this kind of education level, these many kids. Now we can build a digital twin where we feed all that information and we get real-time information. So I can go to that digital twin of a couple and say, okay, are you planning to travel this year? Yes or no? How many times are you planning to travel? Are you considering coming out to our region? What's your perception of the region? Have you heard of Russell Kama? And this is where you start using the data in a more predictive way. And I think that's super interesting to do. So I don't see it as a risk or a liability. It's such an amplifier. It really is. As long as you keep the core functions to yourself.
Mm-hmm. Sure. When we were on stage a couple of weeks ago in Dubai, you mentioned the impact of AI on data and analytics. And of course, we know that there's much that can be done. But you also wondered about how it would impact predictive analytics. And I recall you saying that this is still something that perhaps communicators are seeking, you know, is trying to understand what will happen and trying to be able to predict outcomes. How much of a challenge are you finding that? And do you feel that these technologies may change that equation?
I definitely think that this type of technology will change that equation, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And as you mentioned, a lot of the data that we look at, everything from NPS, so Net Promoter Score, brand lift, brand health, sentiment, tonality, all that comes into play. And data is so important, but it's things that happen in the past. You know, it's a whole saying, there's a cleanup in aisle six. Well, how do you prevent that accident in aisle six from happening? So you prevent mm-hmm. the cleanup. And it's really having that predictive analytics so that you can see around the corner of what might come. And, you know, we're seeing this a lot, especially when you look at reputation and leadership. There's this symbiotic relationship between the two, that you have leaders that are very vocal, that are in the public eye. How do you manage that? Because that is also managing reputation.
Mm. And I read recently that there's this trend of leaders using ChatGPT or whichever their AI platform of choice is for all of their communication now on LinkedIn. Oh. And apparently this is becoming, I think this is challenging comms teams. I don't know if this is something you're seeing, but perhaps something we have to be wary of, because I mean, we're all familiar now with this kind of, you know, AI content, what it looks like. The risk, I guess, is that AI content becomes less effective because it's so homogenous.
It is. You know, I have a particular way of writing. It's a bit grittier. Mm-hmm. I like my style. I've written LinkedIn posts for myself and then, you know, use the AI rewrite function. And then I read it and it's a bit vanilla, it's a bit stale. But I will use it as a thought partner. If I can't finish the sentence, I'll say, hey, can you help me out? This is what it is. Or I'll produce the finished copy and I'll run it by ChatGPT and ask, what do you think of this? And where can I tighten it up? But again, it comes back to using AI in a way that it's an amplifier of what you do, so you don't lose your voice. I don't want to throw away, you know, that elements of style and Strunk and White booklet that, you know, showed me how to write again. I enjoy the struggle sometimes of writing really good prose and getting it out there. So I think it does a disservice to people to be so heavily dependent on it. I suspect it'll catch up. It has to, right?
I mean, I think every day it gets better, right? That's certainly what I'm seeing. So just one more question on working with creators. You mentioned Substack, the rise of the independent journalist or creator. Now there's sort of a gray area between the two sometimes. Do you find you've had to change your engagement approach significantly when dealing with this kind of, you know, this new breed of journalist? And is it kind of also changing perhaps how you deal with the traditional media? I'm curious about this because it does seem like, you know, you need different approaches to deal with different kinds of journalists these days in a way that perhaps wasn't the case, you know, 20 years ago.
It's a very interesting question. Has it challenged us to change? It absolutely has. You do have your traditional journalists that I think the relationship is so important. And this is where we work with PR agencies. And one of the biggest parts is, you know, learning about the journalist and on our mm-hmm. weekly calls, who's doing what, where have they moved, what have they covered. And it keeps both our sides accountable as to the movements in the media landscape, which is really important. So those fundamentals are there, they're in place, and it's important. But as you're working not only with journalists, but various communities, of course, the whole approach needs to change. The way that you produce videos and content changes. You know, the span of attention that somebody has is a lot more reduced. So it's really keeping up to that. But I think an area where we're seeing a lot of growth and potential in is how we leverage our agencies who are an extension of our teams. I think this is such an important piece mm-hmm. to that puzzle. I think in the past, it was almost like a transactional relationship. You would work with an mm-hmm. agency, you would give them a scope of work, they would tick the boxes, and you know, you'd set up KPIs. Media clippings, AVE, and at times that I know I'm laughing now, at times that relationship could get adversarial. It was very zero sum. But WARC did some research about a year, year and a half ago, and they have some compelling evidence that demonstrates that award-winning teams are the ones that have really strong client-agency relationships. A couple of years ago, In Cannes, Marcel Marcondes, who's the CMO of AB InBev, he was presenting on stage and he had a slide that showed all his agencies, so PR, creative, integrated, SEO, you name it. And he called them the Justice League because they were modern day heroes. And it really shows that when you're in sync and in stride all together, you can do some remarkable things. And I think trust is a big part of that. That you can rely on each other to present the work and to complete the work. I think as mm-hmm. on the brand side, we do our agencies a disservice when we don't give them a really good brief. We don't give clear mm-hmm. feedback. We don't give them the amount of time for them to do what they need to do. We leave them floundering. And I think there's a lot of areas that we can build on that trust. You know, I've got the example of, we just launched a summer campaign, a domestic campaign. So awareness of Russell Kamer domestically is quite high. You know, it's a drive market. We don't need to do, you know, the sweeping drone shots and the beautiful visuals that you would see in tourism ads. Those, there's a time and place for that. So we tasked the agency and our agency's Impact BBDO. We've worked with them for almost over a year now. And we said, you know, mm-hmm. take a risk. The communities know us. Come up with something that you think would be edgy. And what they came up with was a really cool narrative. So the whole campaign goes that the agency was ready to film the destination, to do a photo shoot, to even record a voiceover ad. Mm-hmm. But they didn't show up to work, because they were enjoying the hiking in Jebel Jaisar Mountain, they were kayaking in our mangroves, they were enjoying the spa. So our team, my team, we had to scramble and get this campaign off the ground. So we hired Margin Finance in from procurement to shoot the photographs. And of course, they're not skilled, creative people, so their images are all wonky. We ask tourists to film the destination. So one's holding their phone and it's jittery, you know, footage. And even our CEO, Racky Phillips, had to do the voiceover for the radio ad. So it's Rack Summer Unscripted. And it was pretty fun to do. It was really cool. And what I appreciate about it, not only was the idea creative, everyone had buy-in into it. We were about to launch this campaign. It was supposed to go on billboards, but then we were told that there's some regulations and some of our assets wouldn't be on these billboards. And we sat there as a team thinking, okay, what do? We can't reshoot. We don't have time. And the copywriter, Liam from Impact BBDO, came up with a beautiful creative solution that all of us were saying, wow, the copywriters come up with a creative solution. And it just shows that, you know, everyone wants to be part of it. And our PR agency, you know, they just didn't want to issue a press release or invite influencers and media to see the destination. They said, let us own a slice of this campaign. Allow us to form a collaboration with House of Pops, which is a popsicle, a UAE popsicle company, and see if they create a summer flavor for us. And they did. So we've got a summer popsicle called Taste the Sunset in Ras Al Khaimah. And Taste the Sunset comes from my team member, Sadar, who's my head of marketing. For weeks on end, whenever he'd finish work a bit late and drive home, he would take pictures of the sunset in Ras Al Khaimah. And he would send it to our WhatsApp group. And we're like, oh, this is beautiful. What a romantic, you know, day after day, we saw these beautiful sunsets. And now it's expressed in popsicle form. So it just shows how agency, in-house, everyone comes together and has ownership. And it's really a beautiful thing to see.
Yeah, and very interesting to hear of the shift from, you know, perhaps the more kind of overly produced, polished kind of campaign to something that's a little bit more unscripted, something a little bit more unpredictable, probably a sign of the evolution of the market as well. You talked about that shift from, you know, you said adversarial relationships in the past to, you know, a more trusted model. Now, what is it, though, that you are looking for from a good PR agency? What are the qualities that you think set them apart?
A good thought partner, a good sparring partner, and an agency that speaks truth to power. You know, I think I have the answers being in the industry, and I have a particular way of seeing things. But I do appreciate when our agencies challenge us and really come up with ideas of collaboration. It's no longer, okay, you need to issue 2 press releases a month. You need to hit these targets. I really want to see an agency as a thought partner and have that depth of experience and relationships with media, that it's not just sending an email. It's having coffee with a journalist and saying, hey, well, what's happening in your area? Are you seeing writers going to platforms like Substack? You know, I get a lot of relevance from what's happening on the ground and what's happening on the landscape, and it helps inform our strategy. So if, you know, I just need an agency to pump out a press release, I guess I can use ChatGPT to do that now. I'm looking for a lot more than that. Mm. And when the agencies come up with great collaborations, great ideas, it's a win-win for all of us.
Mm. You talked about the importance of knowing what's going on the ground from a tourism perspective. It strikes me as a very interesting time for tourism bodies and for the whole broader concept of nation branding, because we are living in quite a turbulent world at the moment. We have, you know, increasing isolationism, protectionism, polarization, potential trade war, you know, tariffs. And Ras Al Khaimah is not only, you know, in between, well, not in between, but next to quite influential emirates of Dubai and Abu Dhabi. But the UAE as a whole is kind of, you know, jostling with some influential neighbors, and indeed in a very interesting geopolitical position. Has all of this turbulence and potential uncertainty, has it changed how you market Ras Al Khaimah?
I think it's amplified how we market Ras Al Khaimah. And I think UAE in general really showcasing that we are a safe destination to travel to. We have exceptional connectivity as well, major carriers like Etihad and Emirates. Mm. And I think in the case of Russell Kamau, it's really interesting as a challenger brand, one that we worked on. And this is something we started years back, you know, going back to the pandemic, of taking care of our tourism community with our hotels, making sure that we provide a subsidies. We also were the first safe city in the world by Bureau Veritas. So it was really important for us to start building that. And that led to, you know, livability, that not only is Russell Kamau great for tourists, it's great for people who live there. So livability was a big theme. Investment is another theme as well. We have an A-plus rating from Fitch and Poor. So the investment potential is huge. The master planning of the destination. So across 15 years, you'll see a lot of changes in the destination, from green spaces, civic centers, botanical gardens, beach areas. And tourism right now in Russell Kamau accounts for about 5% of the GDP. Our goal is to increase that to become a third in about 10 years. We hope to double our hotel inventory by the end of the decade. And all that leads to becoming a catalyst for growth. We have some amazing brands that are entering the destination, from Four Seasons, Fairmont, to Wynn. So I think in the midst of everything that's happening, just showcasing that we are a safe destination, we're a very inclusive destination as well, which is so important. So many different nationalities, people like myself who've been here for decades almost, who love being here because the opportunities are here. There's a great work-life balance, how families are treated with respect. My son is on the autism spectrum, and when he was diagnosed at 2.5, my husband and I had to see, okay, maybe we need to go back to our respective countries. I'm from Canada, he's from Germany, and look into the services there. But what we found were the services and the inclusivity in the UAE is remarkable. People who are on the spectrum or who have mobility issues, cognitive, they're called people of determination. So there's such a beautiful approach to that. So I think as a society, that fabric is really strong. And I think that helps circumvent a lot of the challenges that you're seeing externally.
Mm. Indeed. You talked about your own perceptions even of the UAE when your son received that diagnosis, and how, you know, they were perhaps upended by the reality on the ground. Do you think that perceptions of the UAE in general have changed? Because, you know, I think we're all familiar with some of the coverage of the UAE from years gone by, particularly from the UK media. Is that era past, do you think? Or do you think there's still perceptions that perhaps need to be addressed, maybe even challenged, in terms of how the UAE is viewed from a global perspective?
I think a lot of work has been done, to your point. You look at Dubai for the past 20 years and what they've done to build up the Emirate and the UAE. Abu Dhabi as well is in full gear. So I think a lot of work has been done there. And given the fact that we have exceptional connectivity, we really are in the center of the world, it's been really important. There still is some work to do. When I go out to media fams, when I go out to media events in different countries, I was in Sweden about a year ago, really to showcase what Russell Kamau has for the Swedish traveler. Some great golfing, nature, hiking, some wonderful hospitality brands. You know, there is some surprise to see a woman there. And when I tell them, it's very progressive. I hold a great position at work. I have opportunities. So I think it's just meeting with people and showing how inclusive the UAE is key. But a lot of that work has been done. For us, I think it's shifting the perception for Russell Kamau that we're not just desert. We're known as the nature. So this is something really interesting. When we were working on the positioning of the Emirate, and this was during the pandemic where, you know, we're talking about the new normal and what are people looking for, far-flung destinations. And we saw this as an opportunity, and we had the time to look at our brand. So we conducted focus groups in many of the countries where, you know, we attract visitors from. And we said, what comes to mind when you think of Russell Kema? And these are trade partners, media, consumers. And the first thing that came up was nature. I was surprised because I was in the region for quite some time. And I didn't necessarily think of nature, but they said nature. Second was leisure. We are a leisure destination. About 90% of our visitors are here for leisure. There is some mice in there as well. Third was adventure. And fourth was culture. And fifth was authenticity. So it shows that maybe the perception of the UAE as a homogenous nation is one that we need to work on. I was speaking to some media in South Africa. I was in Cape Town. And I'm talking about the nature of the emirate. And then I look outside and I see Table Mountain. I'm like, well, South Africans have nature in spades. But also our narrative, our stories, not only do we have mountain, desert, sea, which is part of our nature positioning, we also have Emirati people who are from the mountain, desert, and sea. So then I switched and started talking about the indigenous people, the Emiratis that we have and the culture. And that was really appealing to the South African media. So I think really the work now is finessing, and which is a real joy to do.
Yeah, it's a very good reminder that, you know, sometimes you can take perceptions for granted. But when you go to other countries, that's when you really learn. And indeed, it gives you an opportunity as well to showcase the reality. Rather than necessarily perhaps what people, you know, the ideas that people have or that have been formed in their mind. Alka, thank you so much for your time. This has been a really enjoyable conversation. And I hope to get you back on the podcast in the future. And no doubt I'll see you in the UAE soon. Thank you.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for the opportunity and hope to see you soon in Russell Kema as well. We have a warm welcome.